So it's my pleasure to introduce Michelle Labatt, who's going to talk to us on concussion, which the recommendations seem to change every other week on that. So Michelle has been caring for children and athletes at all levels since 1997. She trained in pediatrics and completed a sports medicine fellowship at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She has subsequently served as team physician, as well as an assistant professor and associate director of the Sports Medicine Fellowship at the University of Hawaii. In 2006, Michelle and her family, lucky for us, moved to Maine, where she began a private practice career at Intermed Sports Medicine Clinic. Michelle is currently a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Sports Medicine and Fitness and has served on the board for the AAP Maine chapter. She also serves on the Strategic Health Initiative Committee on Youth Sports and Health for the American College of Sports Medicine. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Michelle. Thanks, Michelle.
Great. Thank you very much. So this is a topic about which I have a lot of clinical interest. I have absolutely no financial interest in this whatsoever. And as Deb mentioned, this is an area where there is an information explosion going on. There's 4 to 5 articles posted to PubMed every day on this topic. So what I'm going to share with you today is what we think we know right now that is most pertinent to your recommendations and advice that you give to your young patients with concussion. And just to kind of get a lay of the land, so how many people in here now are serving as school nurses? Oh, awesome. So it's a nice kind of mix here, yeah? So, but in spite of all this new information, there's some stuff where things haven't changed a heck of a lot. And in particular, this is just a huge kind of hole, and I will be so happy when there is a gold standard diagnostic test for concussion that will make things so much easier. But even though there's not much change afoot here from our perspective, our medical perspective, our patients feel like there has been a big change, because what they're seeing now is this. This is the blue tent that gets set up on the sidelines of all the NFL games. And when there is an NFL player who is suspected of concussion, they're taken into this tent and the announcers speculate wildly. But all they're really doing in there is they're doing a video analysis, right? And we all have our portable video analysis with us, so increasingly we do that. And the other thing they're doing is they're implementing the recommendations from this latest consensus statement here. And if you really want to delve into the topic of concussion, I would encourage you to download the free full-text PDF off of your favorite search engine. And the most user-friendly part of this document is actually this here. So the Sports Concussion Assessment Tool, 5th edition. How many here use this or are familiar with this in terms of assessing concussion? So a few. Okay, awesome. So let me post this up here. And I don't remember if I thought this or I said this. So there's 2 flavors of this. There's one for kids less than 13. There's another one for 13 and up. I'm going to show you this here. So in that blue tent, they use an electronic version, but the printed version works just as well. And don't pay attention to the details. I just want to kind of show you the layout here. So if this is your patient, you already know this stuff here. If you are not already using a symptom checklist for your concussions, you should. The patient fills this out here. You get a score at the bottom, and it tells you 2 really helpful pieces of information. One is you understand the symptom burden of that patient, and 2, it's a wicked good parameter to follow as they're going through their post-concussion course. Second page, so this is kind of the cornerstone of your cognitive assessment. So memory and concentration are the 2 areas most impacted by concussion. To be honest with you, I have this laminated, I put it in my lap, and this is my cheat sheet when I do my cognitive screen for these patients, so you don't even have to think about it. Third page here, so this is reminder, do the rest of your neurologic exam. And this is a clinical kind of decision-making tool that you may or may not want to incorporate. But once you've told them that you think they have a concussion, right now that's the gold standard for diagnosis of a concussion, is if a healthcare provider thinks you've had one, then by gosh, by definition, you've had one. And they're going to ask you some questions, right? They want to know, how severe is it? And how long is this thing going to last? And my advice to you is to say, each concussion is unique. We don't grade them anymore. It's like being pregnant. Either you did or you didn't, right? And we have no way of knowing how long it's going to last, but there's been a lot of effort put in to try to tease out those factors that might prognose a more difficult time with concussion. And so some of these issues are like pertinent to the kid themselves, right? Things they can't do anything about. These kids here were in the school nurse's office way before they even had the concussion, right? The other one are issues pertinent to the injury themselves. So there's still some conflicting thought on kind of loss of consciousness. So there's some thinking that actually if you lose consciousness, it shuts down that adverse metabolic cascade that happens after concussion and might actually be protective. There are others who think otherwise. But this high symptom load, once you see that on your checklist, you think, huh, this kid might struggle a little harder and a little longer than we would like with this. But so the good thing about youth concussion, right, is tincture of time. They tend to get better. The vast majority of them do get better with passage of time. But some of them don't. And so generally speaking, so for me, if I'm seeing a kid 7-10 days in and they are still struggling with significant symptoms, I'll go through, now granted, I will do that full neurologic assessment, but I'm really looking at these domains in here because we now find that if we can identify ongoing issues here, we can offer up some treatment that might help them get better more quickly. And I'm going to go through these with you. So first of all, so oculomotor, I feel like this is what I see most commonly. These kids have a hard time getting back into school because they can't do this. And remember for reading, right, it relies upon these two things here. So you have smooth pursuit of your eyes left to right as you're going across the page and that rapid saccadic motion kind of back to the beginning. So those both have to be working well for a kid to be able to read. So in the office, so are the ophthalmology people here yet? Because the only thing that I remembered about oculomotor screening from medical school was smooth pursuit, right? Follow my finger with your eyes, make the big H up and down. And what you're looking for is you're looking for reproduction of symptoms. You are looking for evidence of strain, so blinking, pulling, or some evidence that they're not tracking smoothly. For saccadic motion, like I had completely forgotten about this until this kind of came up in concussions. So for saccades, 30 inches apart, 30 inches from the face, I tell the kid, keep your nose facing me, and I want you to go back and forth between my fingers with your eyes as quick as you can. You also want to do that horizontally and vertically. Now, fair warning, most people find vertical more challenging. I don't know if you want to try it, but this is what kids do all day, up and down when they're sitting at their desk at school, right? And if they can't do it in your office, they ain't doing it very good at school. So convergence issues, any kid who's had a history of convergence insufficiency, dollars to donuts is going to come right back out and bite you at the concussion. For convergence insufficiency, at least looking at the concussion literature, if they lose the ability to focus further out than 5 centimeters from their nose, they're said to be receded, they're having issues, their eyes aren't working together as good as we would like them to. So what do we do? So vision therapy can be very helpful for many. And unfortunately, vision therapy used to be a really specialized part of PT, but now that more and more PTs are getting more comfortable with working with concussions, more of them are getting good at this. You can also have them try just kind of a low intensity kind of reader glasses. So, you know, a lot of parents have like minus 1.5s or something like that. They may find that to be very helpful, playing around with font size. And if they're not doing well with that, then you might want to consider this. And I have learned through trial and error that not all optometrists are good at neurooptometry. You want to find one who's comfortable with oculomotor issues, excuse me. What you're looking for from them is to determine, boy, would they benefit from prisms? Or maybe did they have an antecedent refractive error and they just aren't able to compensate for that anymore? But you're looking for guidance along that framework. Vestibular issues. These kids are miserable, right? They can't get back to school. findings. Typically, just through the course of kind of my head neck evaluation, you'll bring the symptoms out. I rarely end up doing a full Dix Hall Pike maneuver in the office. And treatment for that, you can either wait it out or you can send them to physical therapy. And once again, vestibular rehab, you know, there used to be one place in Portland that was good at it, but now a lot of the PT clinics that are used to dealing with sports concussion are doing this increasingly well. You have to tell the patients, though, that sometimes PT works right away. If it's just a matter of kind of relocating one of the otoliths in the ears, a session or two, and bingo, they're better. But a lot of times they feel worse before they get better. And you got to tell them that, because if they don't know that, they're going to be really quick to write off PT as unsuccessful. A lot of times I had a lot of my concussion kids who are traveling and they're more prone to motion sickness. You need to avoid the antihistamines, because that will actually prolong the duration of vestibular symptoms. So neck-related issues. So a lot of times, the mechanism of injury for concussion is really similar to whiplash. Yeah? So the two oftentimes kind of cohabitate in the same patient. Many times I find, at least by the time they come to my office, the neck pain itself has resolved, but they're still having kind of those cervical headaches around through here. Similar fashion, a lot of times they'll really have normal neck exams. So for this, I'm really more driven by the history than by the exam findings per se. And for these guys, the hands-on stuff seems to be effective. So physical therapy, if they've got working relationships with a DO or a chiropractor, a few sessions of that oftentimes can be very helpful. Again, not just for the for any neck stuff, but actually for some of the headaches that might be cervically mediated as well. Sleep, you know, this can go either way after a concussion. You get some kids who are hypersomnolent and they're just sleeping all the time for a couple days afterwards. And that's probably okay because sleep is when concussions do heal. But you get other kids complete opposite. They can't fall asleep or they don't stay asleep and their circadian rhythms get completely messed up. And this is one area where I'm pretty aggressive. Even if I see this within a day or two of concussion, I'm very proactive in terms of, oh, my handouts are here, yay. Yeah, if you could just put a handful on each table or something like that would be great. Thank you so much. My husband had to bring my hand out because I left him on the kitchen table. I'm pretty aggressive about starting melatonin, right? We're the kings and queens of sleep hygiene. And then physical activity, right? If you can't get your wiggles out, you're not going to be able to sleep. And we're going to talk about physical activity in more detail here in a couple minutes. So attention issues. So if a kid had ADHD before, I don't know how often you guys have seen this, it's not uncommon for them to decompensate after a concussion. Or maybe you'll get a kid who's never had attentional issues who swears they've developed ADHD. So in those cases, implement your academic accommodations. As for ADHD, physical activity, once again, we'll talk about, we've been talking about that in regard to this all weekend. The other thing is, if they're not improving, I will sometimes start amantadine on them. So amantadine is dopaminergic. It's come to be known as Ritalin Light. You know, can you see? Am I in your way?
You're good.
Okay, how about over here? So I'll change the landscape here a little bit. So amantadine, it's a non-stimulant. It is dopaminergic. I'll typically start for like 4-8 weeks, depending upon where they are in the academic calendar. And oftentimes they find that kind of gets them over the hump. These guys here. So headaches oftentimes will be due to one of the issues I just got done talking about. But once you're a couple weeks in, these things kind of ping pong back and forth off each other quite a bit, yeah? And I try, especially once they're a few weeks in, I try to kind of normalize those feelings. And the one thing we're really coming to realize about concussion is, you know, we used to think that you recovered your concussion and then you kind of got back into your life. And now we've recognized that, especially for these guys, getting back into your life and normalizing activity is a very important part of symptom resolution. Sometimes in these patients, I'm not a primary care doctor, so I tend not to kind of start with this. Sometimes I'll start with about 10 milligrams of amitriptyline before bed and then kind of titrate up to effect. If I've got some of these symptoms that aren't responding. So it's one thing to kind of say, hey, why don't you guys get back into this? But how do they do it? And so what I'd like to do when I talk about kind of getting these kids back into kind of physical activity in life, I break it down into these three domains here. So one of them is academics. And certainly laying low for a day or two after concussion makes all sorts of sense. But there's good data to show that those who kind of took the middle road, they could do what they could do and then they kind of stopped, did better and more quickly than those on either end of the extreme here, yeah? And for those kids who are having ongoing difficulties, I think it's important to kind of sort out. So are those cognitive difficulties? Are they from the thinking part? Oftentimes it'll be worse in one subject as compared to others. Or is it environmental in nature? Is it the flickering lights? Is it the noisy hallways, the distraction sitting next to you? And if you sort these out, you're gonna be able to come up with some pretty good accommodations. And so one thing that I hear over and over again from school nurses is that they want accommodations that are really pretty specific, and families and patients really welcome that as well. So this is a template, it was put out by the AAP. You can pull it up on your search engine. There's no copyright associated with this. You can change it ad lib. The handouts that came in, I'm not sure if there was enough to go around, but that's just the way my practice has kind of adapted that handout. I've gotten good feedback on that handout. I change it fairly regularly based upon feedback. If there are any school nurses here that want to give me additional feedback, let me know. But they really like the specifics, and especially because it kind of hits on different domains here. So one thing to kind of warn them as you're getting back into school is that it is okay for symptoms to get worse. So you want to kind of have good tolerance for kind of a moderate increase in symptoms. So for instance, if they have a headache that's 2 out of 10, if that headache goes up to a 5 or a 6, that's okay. If it goes up to a 9 or 10, they're not going to get anything done, so they better kind of cut their losses. But let them know that they're not setting themselves backwards by aggravating symptoms a little bit with cognitive activity. This is how kids are studying these days, right? He's got his Spotify going here. He's probably got his computer monitor up here, Skyping with a friend. Concussed kids don't multitask very well. So a lot of times you'll help them be more productive if you can get rid of the peripherals here and just getting them focusing on one thing at a time. And they don't even know that they do it because this is how they all study all the time. Social interactions, similar to academics. We've come to the middle of the road, right? We used to kind of be really strict on restricting screens and that type of thing. That is socially very isolating for these kids. So now, within the AAP common sense parameters for screen time, as tolerated. Again, socialization, social activity, as tolerated. Some schools will have their own specific kind of rules for that, and I encourage families to kind of use common sense, right? So okay for a quiet meal with friends or going shopping with mom, but if you ain't taking your math test, you probably shouldn't go to the school dance, right? And I tell kids that they should have an exit strategy so that if they are kind of involved in an excursion or an event, that they have to be able to kind of let somebody know that that they need to kind of retreat and get back to a quiet spot. Where are we going? There we go. So physical activity. This is one area where things have kind of changed monumentally in the past couple years. So we now know that the earlier you can get them involved in physical activity, right? So we've been listening to Dr. Rady talk about that for a couple of days, and he's right on the money. But it has to be this, and it has to be this. So like on Friday, you got that Friday night concussion. Some kids Saturday, Sunday feeling pretty good, so if they wanna go for a little walk, they wanna take a light yoga class, Tai Chi, somebody was talking about, perfectly fine. And as you're advancing your activity, there's a couple different ways to do it. Bottom line, kind of common sense is start low, go slow, and keep it sub-symptomatic. So unlike cognitive activity where we said okay to kind of work into some increase in symptoms, for physical activity, our current recommendations are not to allow that to happen, to really kind of stay at an activity level that really keeps the symptoms at bay. And you can let families kind of common sense it, but if you got somebody who's really motivated to kind of get back into sport as soon as possible, or somebody where compliance might not be so good, engaging them in physical therapy is certainly optimal. We've come to kind of implement the Buffalo Protocol, named for the city, not the animal. And heart rate monitoring is very helpful because it gives them a concrete number that they can go by. So heart rate monitoring is, I mean, it's more available than ever, right? Our phones, our watches, the handlebars at Planet Fitness. You have them exercise to the point of symptom onset. You set the ceiling heart rate at about 90% of that, and you say you can exercise up to that point, lather, rinse, repeat, and that ceiling goes right up. Important to emphasize that clearing them for physical activity is not the same for clearing them back to their sport. I have learned this the hard way. To get back to activity, contact, collision sport, or others that might increase their risk for head injury, they have to meet all these criteria. Physical activity is part of it, but it's not the whole thing. This hasn't changed for as long as I've been in this business. And yes, cheerleading is a contact sport. For girls, it is the sport with the highest rate of devastating neurologic sequela. So this is what everybody's worried about, right? So we talk about post-concussion syndrome. We used to talk about post-concussion syndrome, but we don't really so much anymore. It was actually taken out of the DSM-5 because there's no consensus. You can still code for it, but it has definitely fallen out of favor as a term. But there's good data in the head injury literature that there are a number of people that come through head injuries with brand new problems that exist far and beyond when the rest of the head injury resolves. Just a couple weeks ago in JAMA Pediatrics, I don't know if any of you guys saw that, they did a 7-year follow-up study on kids who were admitted between the ages of 3 and 7 for traumatic brain injury, and they found out that 62% of them ultimately developed an ADHD diagnosis. So we don't know what the prevalence for that is after concussion. Certainly not as great, but I suspect it's there, and it's an area where we're going to get more and more information over the next couple years. This is another one, right? This is the issue that takes the oxygen out of the room completely. And our knowledge along this area is kind of evolving and down two separate routes. So one is clinical, and so this is kind of good news, right? But the problem with this data is that anytime you have 30 years between the exposure and the outcome, well, there's a lot of problems in there, and we probably won't get it fully sorted out, but this is what we think we know right now. But the other piece of data is the histologic stuff, so the brain slices. Excuse me, this is mostly done down in Boston, down at Boston University. And most professional football players have brains that look like this, but about 20% of high school players, and of course these are very low numbers, have brains that are showing some signs of mild CTE. Now I think the caveat for this for us in this room is that high school football isn't created equal, right? They play high school football very differently in Dallas, Texas than we do in Yarmouth, Maine. So I suspect that kind of our group here probably doesn't reflect this type of risk factor here. I think our risk is probably quite a bit lower. But what we are noticing, or what is emerging, I should say, as a risk factor for CTE isn't so much just the concussive injuries, but it's this cumulative injury. So these sub-concussive impacts, we used to think they were important, and then we didn't think they were important, and now we're kind of thinking that they're important again. So, you know, our advice, soccer players must be very confused, because our advice on heading kind of waxes and wanes depending upon how this is turning out. So regardless of how that goes, I think that the authors of the AAP clinical report on tackling in youth football kind of said it best, right? And then last words here on prevention. So for how much Virginia Tech is respected, these helmet ratings kind of don't pan out when you look at the evidence-based literature. Other labs have not been able to reproduce their claims that their highly rated helmets minimize concussion risk. Helmets certainly are important for a variety of other reasons, but at this point, given current technology, concussions have not been shown to be prevented by appropriate use of helmets. Mouth guards, important for other reasons, but not so much for concussion. Supplements, don't waste your time because of concerns about concussion. So things that you can attach to your head or to your helmet have not been shown to be effective. Anytime you attach something to a helmet, you are almost always going to void the warranty, so don't let people do that. Two things that have been shown to be effective are rule changes. Boy, Canadian peewee hockey has been all over this, and we're just trying to catch up. And then neck strengthening. So the stronger you can get your neck, it's going to enable your body to dissipate that force through the whole body rather than kind of concentrating it on the head. So getting them into a good neck strengthening program, more and more football and soccer programs are doing this. On the horizons, right, so all these kind of fancy tests they're currently using now, research, but they are not ready for clinical use. To be honest with you, I hope these don't become kind of the standard for diagnosis of concussion. These are wicked expensive. Biomarkers, so stuff that you can kind of detect on a blood test, that's an area of very active research. And it looks like we're not all susceptible to concussion and its sequela in the same way. So there is some sense that probably we're going to individualize some of these recommendations down the road. So my take homes here, so get them back into their life as soon as you can within tolerance. Identifying that set of kind of treatable symptoms we talked about pointing them in the right direction can help speed up recovery. Remember, with this, I should put cognitive. So that symptom magnification with cognitive activity is okay. Get parents to buy into that. And then structured return to non-contact physical activity can really help in multiple areas of symptoms. So thank you guys so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Yeah, so two truisms. So one is your biggest risk factor for future concussion is previous concussion, and the more the merrier. And you always want to put as much time between your last concussion and your next concussion. So there's no kind of magic number in terms of how long you need between them. Or how many? No, it is not a three strikes, you're out. I know that's a very kind of common perception. I think what you really want to look for is kind of the pattern. And every family's going to respond differently. It depends upon the role that sports plays in that kid's life and their families. But the thing that really kind of makes me talk about kind of retirement is if there is a pattern of concussive injury where it's easier for them to get a concussion, so it takes less impact for them to have a concussive event, and especially if each concussion has taken a little bit longer and a little bit longer to recover. But if they've had, you know, a concussion in football and a concussion in lacrosse, and they've recovered pretty quickly and completely. Yeah, there's no medical reason to not. Three concussions in a high school or a youth athlete is not enough to produce permanent sequelae, but each one kind of stacks up, right? Each time you're taking out a couple neurons and you ain't gonna get them back. But as long as they're returning back to the same level of cognitive achievement, you've got all sorts of wiggle room. Are you talking about the computerized neuropsych?
Yep. Testing? He got a concussion playing football. He was still having headaches, still confused in school, and he did better on the neuropsych test after the concussion than he did beforehand. Yeah.
So can you guys hear Steve's questions?
And so they wanted him to go back to play. And my brother called me on the phone. And I said no.
Yeah. No, so there is an incredible practice effect with those tests. So that increase, it confounds everything. And that's one of the reasons why if you're doing it the way it should be done, and hopefully all the schools are doing it this way, is they have to be asymptomatic. They have to be back to their prior level of cognitive achievement for the same effort. They can't be working harder to get the homework done. They have to say, I was doing this in an hour before, I'm doing this in an hour now. And then once they've done those, then the last box that you check, if somebody hasn't had a baseline impact, or for middle schoolers, I typically don't impact them. If they've got one kind of sitting out there, yeah, and in the schools you kind of revisit it, but you only do it after those other things because that's just kind of your last little safety valve, but it messes things up if you do it too early. Yeah, yeah.
So
okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sorry,
yeah. I'm gonna be around all day, so yeah, yeah.